Okay, what do you get when you combine Vietnam, two assassinations, Mr. Rogers, and a Big Mac? Welcome to 1968. There's no easy way to explain this one, but we're gonna try. Nixon's about to make a comeback. Buckle up, nerds. Welcome to Backdated, the show where I pick a year and just try to make sense of it. Sometimes with facts, sometimes with feelings, and everything in between. Today, we're heading straight into 1968. And let me just say, this year does not go quietly. We've got the Vietnam War, the assassinations of both Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy, riots at the Democratic National Convention, the Black Power salute at the Olympics, and on a very different note, Mr. Rogers makes his TV debut. Oh, and the Big Mac enters the chat. Coming up in this episode, we will play Headline Roulette, recap the big events, tell you a story that makes you go, wait, what? And of course, deliver a fake ad from 1968, because fake capitalism is the best capitalism. So yeah, 1968. Let's get into it. The first segment of our episode is called Headline Roulette. I will throw out two headlines. One is ripped from the news, and one will be ripped from some AI imagination. All right, I'll read you the headline, and you tell me, is it real or is it totally fake? Here we go. Headline 1. Italian artist sells invisible sculpture for $3,000. Claims it's made of pure energy. Huh. Headline 2. Nixon campaign accidentally sends I'm with Dick buttons to Catholic schoolgirls. Thoughts? All right, drum roll please. The fake headline is the invisible sculpture. The Dick button, this actually happened. A batch of poorly thought out I'm with Dick buttons actually got sent to Catholic schoolgirls. It caused a full-on campaign embarrassment. The slogan didn't make it much further after that. So what did we learn here? History is weird, but AI is weirder. 1968. If this year had a Facebook status, it would say, it's complicated and on fire. This year wasn't just eventful. It was a nonstop parade of chaos, tragedy, revolution, and counterculture. If you ask history nerds, or honestly anyone who lived through it, they'll probably just shake their head and mutter, that year, yeah, that one was rough. If 1968 were a movie, it would be a mix of horror, war epic, political thriller, protest documentary, and experimental French cinema with the Beatles soundtrack. And it would end with the audience throwing their popcorn in disbelief and walking out like, wait, all that happened in one year? So let's break it down. Not as a boring list, but by vibes. Because 1968 wasn't just a series of events. It was a whole freaking mood. Vibe 1. The world is on fire. And not in a fun way. 1968 was a global riot. And I don't mean that figuratively. I mean literally. People were rioting, protesting, marching, shouting, getting arrested, getting shot. It was like the whole world simultaneously said, you know what? Nope. Let's start with these protests because everybody, everywhere was mad. The United States is up first. In April, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis while standing on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel. And when that happened, the country exploded. Over 100 cities saw protesters. People were heartbroken, angry, and asking, what happens to the civil rights movement now? The reaction was immediate and fiery. Over 100 cities erupted in uprisings. Buildings burned, tanks rolled down city streets. People were done being patient. Soon after King's death, the Fair Housing Act was passed. This prohibited housing discrimination based on race, religion, or national origin. At Columbia University, students protested and decided to occupy buildings. Students take over 5 campuses in protest of racial segregation ties and Vietnam research. Police storm in. It's brutal. At the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, anti-war protesters face off with police. The mayor sends thousands of cops and National Guard. The whole world is watching became the chant. Meanwhile, across the Atlantic in France, students and workers basically shut the whole country down. France said, you know what? Let's riot, but make it philosophical. Like, we're talking millions in the streets, the president hiding, and graffiti that said stuff like, be realistic, demand the impossible. Honestly, A+ revolution energy. Students and workers looked around and said, "We want change too, but let's do it with existentialism, tear gas, and baguettes." In May of 68, millions hit the streets. Occupations shut down universities, and the government literally panicked. President de Gaulle fled the country for a day. For real, imagine your leader hearing students are mad and going, "I'm out, call me when the semester ends." Why was France on freakout mode? Well, it started with students, per usual, and they were angry at pretty much everything. The rigid education system, campus freedoms, and the fact that boys couldn't visit girls' dorms. Hey. Once millions of people latched on, it suddenly wasn't just about college rules. It was about the system, capitalism, patriarchy, class inequality, the government, and Charles de Gaulle's very punchable face. Once de Gaulle bailed, rumors swirled that the government had collapsed. Army units mobilized. You know it's bad when the military gets the just-in-case-democracy-fails call. Eventually, de Gaulle came back, gave a dramatic radio speech, dissolved the National Assembly, and called for elections, which he won. But the revolution had already cracked something open in France. Culturally, politically, emotionally. The young generation post-World War II, ready to burn the whole thing down and rewrite the rules. 11 million people. That was 22% of the entire French population. May of 68 became a symbol of youth-led revolt and saying this system doesn't work for us and we're not waiting politely for permission to change it. French students basically said, "I'm not just dropping this class, I'm dropping the regime." They were tearing up cobblestones to throw at police. You know you're mad when landscaping becomes a weapon. In Mexico, students were organizing too, demanding democracy and accountability. But just 10 days before the Mexico City Olympics, government forces opened fire on a peaceful protest. Because that's what governments do, right? It's still unclear how many were killed. Estimates range from dozens to hundreds. But the Olympics went on like, anyway, time for gymnastics. This still baffles me. This is 1968. 1968, and we still couldn't get an exact number of literal bodies. It was an angry, grieving, revolutionary year everywhere. Czechoslovakia saw Soviet tanks rolling in to crush reforms. The civil rights movement even began in Northern Ireland, inspired by the United States activism. The 1968 aesthetic? Blood, smoke, picket signs, and platform shoes. Vibe 2. Vietnam was a disaster, and now everybody just knows it. Let's admit it, the Vietnam War was always a disaster. Each president just made it worse in their own way. 1968, though, was the year of the Tet Offensive. Basically, this was a coordinated surprise attack by North Vietnamese forces during a supposed ceasefire. The ceasefire was set during the New Year, too. Cold-blooded. 100-plus towns and cities were hit at once, including the U.S. Embassy in Saigon, which was supposed to be secure. Spoiler alert, it was not. Quickly held the line, armed forces were struggling over there. Americans watched the war on TV, and they were like, "Wait, I thought we were winning. This looks like we're very much not winning." This was the first war that we watched in real time from our living rooms during dinner. People were losing hope, losing faith, and everybody was just losing in general. And then came Walter Cronkite, America's most trusted news anchor, the voice of calm and reason in American households. He went to Vietnam, looked around, came back, and basically said, "I don't think we're going to win this war. Best case scenario, stalemate," which, in Cronkite speak, is the equivalent of yelling, "Fire!" in a crowded democracy. President Lyndon B. Johnson, hearing this, reportedly said, "If I've lost Cronkite, I've lost Middle America." And then, just a few weeks later, he announced on national TV, "I shall not seek and will not accept the nomination of my party for another term." Translation, I'm out. The war broke me. You know it's bad when the president calls it quits mid-war, like a teacher walking out halfway through a school year. But if the Tet Offensive made Americans question the war, my lie made them question their country. Many were asking whether we were even the good guys anymore. Here's what went down. On March 16, 1968, a group of U.S. soldiers from Charlie Company rolled into a village in South Vietnam called My Lai Four. The mission? Root out Viet Cong insurgents. That's what they were told. That's what they were prepped for. But there were no Viet Cong. There were no guns, no fighters, just civilians. Mostly old men, women, and children. And instead of turning around, instead of realizing this was a mistake, they started killing people. And I don't mean fog of war killing. I mean lining people up, shooting them, throwing bodies into ditches. Women were raped and mutilated. Children were shot point blank, babies. Over the course of 4 hours, American troops massacred over 500 civilians, whole families wiped out, and no one stopped it. Except one guy, Hugh Thompson. A helicopter pilot was flying overhead. He saw what was happening and literally landed his chopper between the soldiers and some villagers. He told his crew to open fire on their own fellow Americans if they didn't stop. Let me say that again. A United States soldier aimed guns at other United States soldiers to stop a war crime from getting worse. Thompson managed to rescue a few survivors and immediately reported what he saw. And the military did what the military often does in 1968 when it finds something inconvenient. It covered it up. They tried to spin it as a, and I'm using air bunnies here, successful engagement. The internal report buried everything. For over a year, no one talked about it until November 1969. The news story broke. America collectively gasps. You've got the war playing out on TV every night, right? But now, people are reading about American soldiers killing children. And not in a firefight, but in cold blood. It was horrifying. It was shattering. Even people who supported the war were questioning everything. Now about the fallout. Lieutenant William Calley, the officer in charge that day, was eventually convicted of murdering 22 people. His sentence? Life in prison. But he only served 3 years, at home, under house arrest. Because of course he did. No one else faced real consequences. A few wrist slaps here and there, but for the death of over 500 civilians, the U.S. military basically shrugged and moved on. And that, more than anything else, may have been the moment Americans truly realized we are not the heroes in this story. It was the ugliest chapter of the war, and maybe the ugliest of the entire year, which, by 1968 standards, is really saying something. It didn't make headlines until the next year, but it happened in 68. This is the darkest asterisk you'll ever see in a history book. Vibe 3. Hope gets shot twice. If there was another word needed to define 1968, it would be grief. On April 4th at 6:01 p.m. in Memphis, Tennessee, standing outside room 306, Dr. King was shot by a white supremacist. He was in Memphis supporting a sanitation workers' strike. The strike began after two black garbage collectors were crushed to death in a malfunctioning truck, and workers had long protested low wages and dangerous conditions. King believed economic justice was the next frontier in the civil rights movement. He called it the Poor People's Campaign. He was shot in the jaw and neck by a single bullet from a high-powered rifle, and he was pronounced dead at 7:05. The night before he died, King gave his famous I've been to the mountaintop speech. He said, I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. Many have pointed to the speech's eerie foreshadowing, almost as if he knew what was coming. James Earl Ray, an escaped convict and known racist, was arrested 2 months later in London. He pleaded guilty, then immediately recanted, claiming he was set up as part of a larger conspiracy. Ray spent the rest of his life in prison and continued to maintain his innocence. Even King's own family, especially Coretta Scott King and MLK III, believed Ray did not act alone, if at all. Ray's rifle was found wrapped in a blanket, left at a nearby amusement company building. His fingerprint was on it, but some ballistic experts later said that the bullet couldn't definitively be matched to the gun. Theories about FBI involvement, mafia connections, or government complicity have swirled for decades. People mourned, but they also raged. It wasn't just a tragedy. It felt like a warning that peace and justice weren't safe, no matter how powerful or peaceful the person was. So much hostility swept the nation. Washington, D.C. had to call in the National Guard. Robert F. Kennedy was in Indianapolis about to give a campaign speech when he learned of King's death. Instead of skipping the appearance, he told the crowd the heartbreaking news himself. He delivered one of his best, most heartfelt speeches, quote, even in our sleep, pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart. That night, Indianapolis stayed calm while cities around it burned. Many credit RFK's words for that, which is the perfect segue for important assassination number two. Right when the country began staggering to its feet, Robert F. Kennedy, running for president on a platform of civil rights, anti-poverty, and pulling out of Vietnam, wins the California primary. He gives his speech, he walks into a hotel kitchen, and he's shot, dead at 42. Minutes after he is confirmed the primary candidate, he is shot.
As he walked through the kitchen, he was shot at point-blank range in the head by Sirhan Sirhan, a 24-year-old Palestinian-born man. Five others were wounded in the chaos. RFK did not die on the scene, however. He lived for 26 hours, unconscious in the hospital after extensive brain surgery. Sirhan had written in a notebook, "RFK must die before June 5th. That was the anniversary of the Six-Day War, in which Israel had defeated several Arab nations. RFK was pro-Israel, and Sirhan blamed him for supporting U.S. arms deals with them. He later claimed to have no memory of the shooting. Weird thing to forget, bud.
Multiple witnesses claimed RFK was shot from behind, even though Sirhan was in front of him, fueling theories of a second gunman. Acoustic experts in 2007 claimed more shots were fired than Sirhan's gun could hold. He only had 8 bullets. Even RFK's own son, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., has expressed doubts that Sirhan acted alone. Obviously, this causes more conspiracy theories to enter the stage here. Shortly after his death, the United States issues its first handgun control bill. It banned mail-order guns, like the ones used to kill Kennedy. That's right. In 1968, you could literally Amazon Prime a rifle. It took a second assassination to go, wait, maybe not. RFK's funeral train moved from New York to Washington, D.C., and people lined the tracks in total silence as it passed. Black and white, young and old, holding signs, crying, just watching. The energy that had once said, we can change this, turned into something much colder. Maybe we can't. Vibe 4. Culture gets weird, loud, and naked. Now, while all this is happening, American culture said, okay, but hear me out. What if things were also totally trippy? First up, music. The Beatles released the White Album. It's all over the place. There's folk, experimental noise, proto-metal, and a song about a raccoon, R.I.P. Rocky. They also spent part of the year meditating in India with the Maharishi, which feels very 1968. Meanwhile, Johnny Cash records his iconic live album at Folsom Prison. And now you've got inmates singing, I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die while clapping along. Jimi Hendrix releases Electric Ladyland, which album art included 19 naked women. 4 British guys got together and said, huh, what if blues music put on dragon pants and did a keg stand? Boom, Led Zeppelin was born. On Broadway, hair debuts and shocks everyone. There's nudity. There's a song literally called Sodomy. There's also anti-war protest and psychedelic visuals. It wasn't just a musical, it was a whole cultural shift. In theaters, Planet of the Apes ends with that unforgettable twist, the Statue of Liberty half buried in sand. America? Shocked. College students say, it's a metaphor. 2001 Space Odyssey is released. What if a movie was visually groundbreaking, deeply confusing, and didn't really care if you understood it? Mr. Rogers debuts and gently walked kids through all sorts of tough issues all while wearing that cardigan. Star Trek features one of the first interracial kisses on U.S. television. William Shatner became the GOAT. And Night of the Living Dead basically invents the zombie genre. Vibe 5. The election that felt like a brawl. The 1968 election was the kind of messy that you usually only get at family Thanksgiving. Richard Nixon, back from the political dead. Tricky Dick himself. By 1968, he was basically a political zombie. He'd lost to JFK in 1960, then lost again running for governor of California in 62. He gave a salty press conference where he was like, you won't have Nixon to kick around anymore. And everyone assumed, cool, bye forever. And then, plot twist, he comes back in 68, like full-on political resurrection. Except this time, he's not pitching hope or unity. He's running on something called law and order. Now, that sounds reasonable. Like, sure, law, order, no chaos. But in the language of 1968, law and order was a dog whistle. It was code for, I'll be the guy who cracks down on protesters, rioters, hippies, and anyone who's making middle America feel anxious right now. He also started talking about the silent majority, which was basically all the white suburban folks who don't protest, don't march, and wish everyone else would just shut up and mow their lawns. He wasn't saying that racism was okay. He just wanted everyone to stop yelling about it. So while the country was burning, bleeding, screaming for change, Nixon steps up and goes, hey, I can make it all quiet again. You've been ignored, overlooked, and shouted down, Nixon said. I hear you. And a lot of people were like, honestly, that sounds nice. Nixon's big promise was to bring the war to a close. He said, I have a secret plan to end the war. Did he actually have a plan? Who knows? But he leaned hard into this message. I'll end this mess, but without losing. He appealed to Americans who didn't want to keep fighting in Vietnam, but also didn't want to admit that we'd lost, which, to be honest, was most of the country. He looked put together, calm, collected, like he just ironed his tie and read the Constitution for breakfast. And boom, he wins. Not with the majority of the vote, but with enough to flip the script. The comeback was complete. The grave, empty. Nixon was back, baby. And if you don't like Nixon, well, he is far better than the third party option, George Wallace. Openly racist, segregationist, wins 5 states. His campaign slogan should have been, I miss Jim Crow. Imagine saying that on a campaign trail. 1968 was just built different. And now a quick word from our fake sponsor.
Are you tired of your burger having only one bun and basic ambition? Well, get ready, America. Because in 1968, McDonald's isn't just flipping patties. They're flipping expectations. Introducing the Big Mac. That's right, 2 all-beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun, and the other patty, and another bun. And honestly, more sauce than anyone asked for. Nutrition facts? Unclear. Heartburn? Highly likely. But hey, it's the Cold War. We all might die tomorrow. You might as well go out with a mouthful of mediocre beef and 900 calories of hope. The Big Mac. It's big, it's messy.
It's time for this episode's wild card, the part of the show where history suddenly turns into a fever dream. So did you know that in 1968, Andy Warhol was shot by a radical feminist in his studio and survived only because the doctor literally massaged his heart with his bare hands? True story. Let's set the scene. Warhol, pop art king, you know, banana guy, soup can guy, is running his iconic studio, The Factory, which is part art lab, part celebrity chaos, part drug-fueled daydream. Enter Valerie Solanas. She's a struggling writer, radical thinker, and author of something called the Scum Manifesto, which stands for, wait for it, Society for Cutting Up Men. Yeah. She'd once given Warhol a script to produce. He lost it. So naturally, she walked into his studio with a gun and shot him 3 times. Warhol's spleen, stomach, liver, lungs, everything was damaged. Doctors were about to declare him dead, until one surgeon reached in, grabbed his heart, and massaged it until it started beating again. He survived. Barely. But from that day forward, Warhol always wore a surgical corset under his clothes, like pop art Batman. Also, fun fact, Solanas turned herself in that day and said, he had too much control over my life. Honestly, that's one of the most 1968 sentences ever spoken.
Some other huge 1968 events include the first 911 call being made. This happened in good old Alabama. Apollo 7 launch. This was the first successful manned space flight of the Apollo program. We head to the moon in 1969, not 1970, a year sooner. NASA even sent a monkey up to space because when your year already includes war, riots, and assassination, why not traumatize a monkey at 17,000 miles per hour? The first ATM got installed in London. Ziplocs came out. Yale admits women for the first time. Let me repeat that for the people in the back. Yale did not allow women until the year that Ziploc bags hit grocery stores. The first successful heart transplant occurred in the US. The patient died 14 days later, but hey, medical progress. Mr. Clean does his thing. Mattel releases Hot Wheels. So yeah, 1968 wasn't just politically explosive. It was like the entire planet took acid, read a conspiracy theory, and decided to innovate. It was chaos and progress, tragedy and Hot Wheels, all speeding forward at 17,000 miles per hour, and that's what makes 1968 so wild. It wasn't just a year, it was a full-blown icon of a year.
Now welcome to Cancel Corner, where we will take a hard look at someone from our chosen year and ask, would they survive a Twitter news cycle today? Today's guest, J. Edgar Hoover, the human trench coat and paranoia machine who ran the FBI like it was his personal Mean Girls Club. This guy bugged MLK's hotel rooms, tried to drive him to suicide, and kept secret files on politicians like it was some Cold War version of TMZ. Twitter would have eaten him alive. Reddit would have subpoenaed his emails. So, this week we're going with J. Edgar Hoover. All right, folks, we're going to finish up with a game we like to call Guess That Price, where everything's cheaper and your jaw drops in retro disbelief. I'll give you an item that was on the market in 1968, and you try to guess what it cost back then. Let's start with none other than the Big Mac. How much did it cost in 1968? Answer? 49 cents. That's right, less than two quarters. All right, next one. How much for a base model Mustang in 1968? Think about it. Answer? $2,602. Today, that wouldn't even get you tires and Bluetooth. 1968 was the year that seams came apart. It was grief and rage, revolution and repression. It was the sound of a generation screaming, "Something's gotta give," while the government quietly slipped earplugs in. And somehow, in the middle of all that, people were still making music, still running for office, still getting haircuts like they were in the Monkees. That's the thing about history, though. It doesn't pause so you can breathe. It just keeps rolling. In 1968, it rolled over everything.
Backdated was written, hosted, and emotionally overwhelmed by Brianna Gillen. Research assistant and professional conspiracy theorist, also Brianna Gillen. Fact-checking by Our Inner Guilt About Middle School History Class. Editing done with GarageBand, duct tape, and a white monster. Theme music, that one royalty-free jam that totally slaps, sourced from Free Music Archive. Executive producer, my cat Udi, who kept walking on the keyboard during editing. You can always check our show notes for any questions that you have about our sources, and we would like to thank the following. To 1968 for somehow cramming five decades of chaos into 12 months. To Mr. Rogers for being the emotional band-aid we didn't know that we needed. And to the internet for still arguing over whether there was a second shooter. Leave a rating or review or just scream backdated into the void, whatever helps.